ship now.
We can't! Trapped and they're about to break in!
I'm Christian Colleen, with me James McLean. I'm Brian Terranova. And, well, that was a cliffhanger, wasn't it?
Yeah,
that was a cliffhanger. And we're here to talk about Ascension of the Cybermen. There's a lot of questions. There's a lot of good things about the episode. There's questions about the episode. Do you know what? I'm going to start this off with a very big positive note, okay? We've talked at length on the podcast with AK over the past sort of 5 years or so about perhaps the need for Doctor Who to evolve beyond what it had been doing. And a couple of wobbly episodes aside this year, I'm kind of getting the feeling that maybe actually that is what is actually happening right now. That actually the show is actually moving towards a slightly different type of storytelling that maybe it was doing back in 2005 to 2010, but kind of upping, just improving it, streamlining it a bit, making, giving a greater engagement factor without the requirement to tune in every week. Does anyone have any thoughts on that?
Pertaining to this specific episode, what it's done, you mean?
And the things that have been leading up to it, and you know, we had that kind of period with season 10 where it felt like there's going to be something bigger going on, and although there was, it was something complete, it was something that was very big, perhaps by necessity of people moving on and coming and going behind scenes.
It dropped off.
It dropped off, didn't it? You thought there was something going on with the Master, Missy, and it turned out to be a bit of a damp script, perhaps. Whereas this time around, it feels there's more of a cohesion to it. James, do you think?
I feel Brian should... Okay. I think Brian was going to say stuff.
I was going to say something. I'm curious about yours. But it's part one. Okay, so I do kind of feel like what you were saying with Series 10. I remember watching Series 10 and doing the podcast on that, and we were all kind of excited it was going somewhere, you know, or even at the time talking about it. And then when it got to the end, like I said, it dropped off. You know, it seemed like it was going somewhere. There was a misstep or two in there, and it felt good. It was finally like, and I'm just going to say it, but it was finally like the Moth era was hitting its stride after all that time. This season, it seemed there were a lot of missteps along the way. I think the podcast shows our feelings on that. But this episode particularly, and it's one to go before the end, you know, or one right before the end. So I don't know if it's going to drop off. But I remember watching this thinking that I had similar feelings watching Caves of Androzani. I don't know if you guys felt that, but I felt like this is the tonal shift. This is the type of story that we should be telling. Mind you, the cliffhanger-y bit at the end started to put that, as we say here, the agita back in me. It could be good, could be fine, but it was like, man, this episode was good, and then they hit you with that thing at the end, and I'm like, ah, crap, where's it going to go?
Yeah, because there's a lot of things this season that they're going to either have to cover or they're not going to cover. I mean, I get the impression that Jack's going to be in next episode solely because they have the, you know, the reawakening from the dead in the scene where he falls off the cliff was very Jack-esque, wasn't it? So,
yeah,
I kind of wondering whether there's meant to be some sort of bloodline there. I don't know, but it feels like there's a lot for it to sort of tie up, especially if you take the Ruth thing in there as well, whether that's going to be acknowledged again or not, whether that's next season on. Yeah, I know. I think it's been a good season, to be honest. I think there's been, as you say, there's been pockets of moments where it's felt like it's falling back into its old, old conventions, or there's been times where it's felt it just hasn't hit the mark. But I mean, things like the structure of this story, where you have this very this second story that doesn't even come to a fruition at the end of it. This backstory that obviously is connected to what's going on in some way. It's sort of very different ways of telling Doctor, which it hasn't done. And I felt that a lot through this season. They've been trying these different ways and sometimes going back and trying stuff they've done before. And some of it's been successful, some of it not so. But I think you're right, Christian. I agree that it has felt very different. And as you say, Brian, I don't know whether next episode, like with the end of season 10, yeah, where it just sort of fell back on old habits, maybe it will again, I don't know. But I like the flow of this episode. I mean, kind of still feel that the Cybermen felt a little new to it, even though they felt very powerful. They didn't really ever get anyone, if you know what I mean. It was a lot of running away from things. I mean, the most dangerous things were the flying heads.
Well, they got the guy's father, didn't they, early on?
Yes, I suppose so.
And
that's the oddity, though, for me. Like, the flying heads are one thing. That's one of my notes. I think the flying heads, the Doctor calls them drones. I think they should have been drones, not flying heads. But number two, yes. Didn't you find it odd that they were killing humans rather than, like, grabbing them to convert? That was the only kind of, like, oddity for me.
But I think this is the point, isn't it? That he is not doing the Cyberman thing.
There, you think is this is all because of the lone Cyberman?
Yeah, I think that was the feeling I was getting, that there was like an eradication rather than assimilation. I didn't like the heads. I mean, the idea was fine, but there's just nothing particularly powerful in a load of floating cyber heads. It looks
there was something comical about it, wasn't there? It could have been like a Terry Gilliam Cybermax animation, just lots of heads flying all over the place.
Yes. Yeah, it's like a flying Cybermat design would be something that's got a little more, that would have perhaps worked better.
Cybermats with wings.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Something, or just like, you know, the ships had an interesting design, but imagine them being smaller and drone-like.
Mm.
You know, and I'll say this too, when the episode opened, it was one of the best intros they'd had. I mean, ignore the monologue, which was fine. The monologue worked, but it was a gorgeous intro. And seeing that Cyberman head floating in space was really interesting, because I thought it was like the leftover remnants of a Cyberman and a cyber war. And maybe it was. But when you see the floating drone heads look identical, it's all of a sudden just like, oh, was that just a drone? You know, so it was a little bit weird going from one to the other.
But I also like, I mean, like you just briefly put up, I like the opening monologue as well, in the sense that it's the first time we've kind of acknowledged this weird tension within the Cybermen and within the franchise, where they're extremely powerful. And yet there's an acknowledgement that they fail quite a lot. They're often nomadic. They're often, you know, as they say, the cyber wars, and then being defeated by the glitter gun and all that sort of thing. And how this show sort of kind of acknowledged all those elements, and where you have the three-piece set of defenses that they have, which sort of acknowledge those ways of trying to attack Cybermen in the past, through, you know, attacking their emotions or the gold allergy, and how then it wipes those out as well, is a sort of very nice statement. He seemed to do the right things in trying to make the Cybermen more of a threat. All the things that Nightmare and Silver got wrong, it got right.
Tried to put that to the back of my mind, Nightmare and Silver.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was, as we said at the time, it was ridiculous. You make them so overpowered, that they get overpowered, that they their defeat makes them seem even weaker than normal. It was a really weird episode, but this sort of carried that tension, and the tension with the companions was good as well. You had this feeling of fragility and mistakes and vulnerabilities, you know, that they were in the wrong places rather than the right places. They were saying the, you know, the companion mantra over the last 15 years, you know, we'll sort this out for you. And you were feeling this uncertainty of whether they really could, and whether they were starting to realize that they possibly couldn't, and how much of their good fortune has been due to the main character, and how much due to luck as well. And is that going to run out? So I think there's some really nice, good bits of tension in there too. Again, defying that sort of usual conventions of the show, which again is what's made this series feel a little different.
Yeah, definitely. I think as well, I mean, there's some great nods to Classic Who as well, not least in the new Cyberman warrior design, and the fact there's a freighter full of Cybermen. And, you know, as it got towards the end of the episode, I genuinely was expecting "My Army Awaits Doctor" to be uttered, or "My Army Awaits" at least. It felt like, you know, that scale, that sort of Earthshock sort of scale of cyber threat, didn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
It definitely had that kind of feel, even when they started walking out of the chambers. But yeah. I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of glad they didn't go that route. Well, I do think they made some odd choices.
It would have been nice if it wouldn't have hurt, would it? But yeah, maybe you're probably right. Probably best that they didn't.
I mean, it would be interesting, and I don't think they're going to go down this route because it becomes very anal. But the Cybermen in this, especially with the ideology of the lone Cyberman, feels like the 80s Cybermen, the 70s, 80s Cybermen.
Yeah.
Even the voices that they were using, the intonation was starting to sound very much like those 80s Cybermen, slightly nerdy sort of intonation. Which was very different to the Cybermen we've had in the classic, in the series, in the new series. And so, you know, that again is quite interesting. I don't think they're going to go there, but certainly it's a place where fans or Big Finish could speculate upon. It felt like a very different Cybermen episode, and it felt like the series was acknowledging that there has been a series of failures with Cybermen in the show. I don't know whether that's just me, but that opening monologue to me almost felt like an acknowledgement that these beings just haven't really had a good run, even though they're meant to have. Somehow they haven't, and this is going to try and correct it. And especially
being
this
a bit rubbish, and here's why.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And also this, but then they automatically correct this by, which makes total sense, you know, because we don't really get to see Earth after the Cyber Wars, bar Revenge of the Cybermen, as far as I can think of. And this idea that, you know, that humanity is pretty much decimated, certainly as they point out this side of the galaxy. So they're not trying to suggest that these are the last humans, but there are very few humans left after the Cyber War, which again sort of amps that sort of threat, maybe with a slight retcon there, but a believable retcon.
Yeah, definitely. So a few words about some of the people that were in the episode. Julie Graham was one of the survivors, which is nice because she was in the show Survivors.
I was going to say that, yeah.
Yeah, so I thought that was kind of nice bit of casting. I'm Nick Briggs as the Cybermen, and Patrick O'Kane again as Ashad, and Il McElhinney from pretty much loads of stuff over the years, but he's best known more recently for, there's a show from Ireland that he's done recently, I can't remember the name of it, but he was also in Game of Thrones as Sir Barristan Selmy until, I think it was the sixth series, was the weakest series, wasn't it?
Debate on that.
Yeah, but he got killed by a load of those masked people, which was a shame because he was awesome up to that point. And right at the end, the Master, Sacha Dhawan, pops up. And you kind of had a feeling that he might just appear at that point. But then after that, they dwelled on the Gallifrey Capital View for a moment, didn't they? And then you thought, oh well, hang on, something else is going to happen here, and is it going to be him? And it was. It's very difficult to be, I suppose, especially when you kind of critically minded as we are, to sit and be satisfied so much by an episode of Doctor Who. But this is one of the best times watching. I'm not going to say it's one of the best episodes at this point, because we've got a lot of talking to do. But I wasn't looking at the phone. I didn't look at the clock. I was gripped throughout. I even had to wait for a phone call. And, you know, I wasn't even the screen was paused and I was just looking at the screen for the duration of this phone call. So I was gripped, I think is the word, even when it wasn't actually on.
Yeah.
And that was very early doors.
I've said many times this series and the last that there were great pacing issues with the stories. And I didn't feel that with this one. I felt that they used time pretty well. I felt that they split the TARDIS team up pretty well this time, too. Mm-hmm. They didn't just go give the Doctor a pseudo companion. I liked that. I actually liked that she got stuck with Ryan this time. It seemed a pairing that we don't really see.
Yeah, it seems like something that's not happened before.
Yeah, and it worked pretty well. And then also, you know, I also liked on the spaceship that Yaz and Graham could come up with ideas, even though they don't know how to work this technology. They just had like base plans and base ideas. And I think the things were really working for me. And I won't say like it's been the best for many, many years kind of thing. But I don't think I remember enjoying an episode to this degree since Capaldi's last, which surprised me. And I'll be honest, by that point, I had kind of dropped off the series a little bit. As you guys know, I wasn't doing the podcasts and so on. And I kind of had felt the show moved on from something that I enjoyed. So I actually watched Capaldi's final episode more than a year after it aired. And I enjoyed it. There were things about it that I was a little iffy on, but I really enjoyed that. And I think that was the last time I actually remember feeling like, man, I absolutely enjoyed that episode prior to obviously the Mary Shelley episode was pretty good, but this one got me more. This one I was just really gripped by this one. I really liked the setting. The visuals yet again are just stellar. They're just killing it these past two series with the cinematography. Little hiccups, like we said, the cyberheads and so on. But there are interesting questions left lingering, which I love when an episode can do that. Like James, you brought up that, what's his name, Brandon. Very similar, yes, to Captain Jack, right? And I thought the same thing. Like, what's this story? What's this side story? Where are they going with this side story? And it was kind of like at first when they were doing it, I'm like, man, get back to the regular story. But then I was like, wait, where's this going? And then it got weird at the end. You know, he's the only one aging in that world. And I thought, is this a Captain Jack situation then? Or is this the Timeless Children? Is this what is going on over here? Is this somehow related to the Cybermen? Is this related to the Time Lords? And it does leave you at the end really trying to figure out what's going on, but not in one of those, oh my God, where the hell are they going with this? It was really more so interesting. You're sitting there trying to theorize, which is one of my favorite things about any show that I watch. You're left literally trying to figure out what is going on in kind of the best possible way.
I agree with that. I mean, I think I preferred last week's personally, but I just, this felt on par. And again, I'm very aware, like we've said before, it's not to say that this is how Doctor Who should be done. It's just simply, it's a type of Doctor Who which appeals to me as a sort of older adult who has seen the show a lot. It's engaging me in ways because it's feeling fresh and slightly different. So, you know, for me, this was a really good episode. While, you know, for maybe, I think as we said, you know, things like the Tesla episode or maybe Spyfall might appeal more to a younger audience. But I'm just looking through the episodes of this season so far, and I think it's been a very good season, largely. I mean, say Orphan 55 obviously had us feeling a bit awkward. And let's say the Tesla one didn't really appeal to me personally, but I think it had a lot of good classic Doctor Who stuff in there. You know, with the Jadoon one was very interesting. Again, very different. I like the Praxeus one. Can You Hear Me had some interesting stuff in there. Again, a bit mixed, a bit messy, but there's a lot of stuff going on that was interesting. And use of the companions was good. We liked The Haunting last week, and this has been solid. So, I kind of think it's in a good place. And while I don't think that's going to detract from people who dislike it, I do wonder 6 years down the line when people look back at it, it may have a stronger appeal than is, you know, some of the fandoms, especially on YouTube, are shouting about it at this moment. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on here, and I think you've got to give it credit for that. It's not doing the same thing, and it's, as you say, it's utilizing companions well, and it's finding ways to use them to try and make things fresh. You know, this is 15 years, this show now. It needs to be fresh. It needs to find new ways of doing things. And it's trying. And that's not an easy job. As we've said, we still think there's ways to make it easier by not going back to Earth so much, drop in a couple of non-contemporary companions, et cetera, et cetera. But for what it's doing, I think it's doing some good work. And so, I like feeling surprised by it. When I go into it, I don't know where it's going to be going. And that's a nice feeling.
Yeah, that is a nice feeling. Before we take on board some of the comments from our listeners, there's obviously a few things going on in the episode. We've got, as you mentioned, the Irish stuff going on with the Brandon character. We've got the whole thing with the Master. And we've got whatever the aim of the Cybermen is, which might be, I don't know. It feels as though it might be something similar to what the Daleks were trying to do in the Stolen Earth to some degree. But, I mean, does anyone dare speculate as to what's coming next? It's a two-parter, after all.
My sincere concern is that they're going to try and put too much into the next episode. Like, the pacing on this was great. And I just think that there's a lot left dangling. But I believe I mentioned this before, too. When I saw Spyfall Part 2 in the theater, there was a Q&A session with the Dr. Yaz and Ryan. And they specifically asked Jody if, you know, like they said something like, I can't wait to find out about the Timeless Child and this, that, and the other, and what's going on there. And Jody was very specific to say that answers are coming, but you might not get them all this series. Mm-hmm. So part of me thinks, like what James is saying, that, you know, maybe they're not going to focus on everything, that they're going to hang on for some till next series, which on one hand would kind of alleviate the stress that they're going to put too much into the episode. But then on the other hand, it's going to be, it's not going to be great if you leave something dangling that we're all sitting here kind of, I don't know a better way to say it aside from saying, like, ticked off about. Like, if it's the part that's going to rewrite the past, which I'm always leery of in anything, I do not like prequels, you know, because prequels always answer questions that shouldn't be answered, you know, rarely is a prequel done well. So when you go back and you revisit the past in any way and you try and explain something that doesn't need to be explained, typically it's done poorly or rewrites something that was better than what you've come up with. So that's my concern there. But I don't know if they keep up the pacing and the storytelling of the last two episodes. I don't think I'm as hopeful for the rest of this season as James was. I think they're making a lot of the right strides. I think they're correcting a lot of the things that I had issues with in series 11. But I think with these last two episodes, they really kind of found their footing. And if they continue that, I'll be pretty happy. But I just think the storyline that they're building up with the Master and Gallifrey and the storyline that they were building up with Ruth are places that I'm concerned about. And I don't know what to expect. And if you're going to shoehorn Jack further into a last episode rather than utilize the time that you have across a two-parter to kind of really get him in there, I'm concerned about that as well.
I'm totally on board with what you're saying there. I think I can handle a revision of the Time Lords, because there's been so many revisions of the Time Lords already, but a revision of the Doctor's origins, that's doesn't sit well with me, to be honest.
I still don't think I still think this is to do with fractured time. I think we've talked about this before. I think that's where we're going with this, that it's not a rewrite. It's another utterly valid timeline which has been created. I think the fact that they made that big thing about the sonic screwdriver and are not getting what that was, to me, suggests that this is not meant to sit. Because even if, I know, again, YouTube shouters have been sort of saying, oh, this is clearly the bit between the second and the third Doctor. This is between Troughton and John Pertwee, between the War Games and Spearhead. And again, it's like, well, Troughton had a sonic as well. I just don't really feel.
Right.
And I think that's too. I mean, the show clearly doesn't do the big finishing. If it was a big finish, I'd say, yeah, probably. But it's not. And I don't think they're going to do something as nuanced as that in terms of canon. I think that And I would not be entirely surprised if Ruth is a hangover, because they don't really go into that. And I would actually probably say that might be wise. Because if that, we know we've got like 50 minutes next week to cover, satisfactorily cover this Cybermen story, the Martyrs' inclusion, rewrites and Gallifrey, that feels like enough. And I'd rather they did that and left her wondering about the Ruth thing, or whether that could be sort of suggested is relevant to this story, but not actually immediately engaged, or not, or doesn't have any more confrontations with that. I think that could be a good move.
See, I had this. I'm sorry, Jen.
No, I'm good.
I had this this theory. So I kind of agree with you. I don't really think it's a rewrite, but you know, there's always, whenever somebody goes anywhere toward that area, any kind of prequel-esque kind of area, you know, the hairs on the back of my neck stick up, because I just, we've been burned too many times in too many franchises with that kind of thing, in my opinion. But I do kind of agree with you. I think it's not a rewrite. I think it's either, you know, an alternate valid timeline, as you said, something maybe that was created because of whatever's going on in this storyline, or maybe something that was always there. Another part of me, though, had this theory that maybe, you know, the timeless child that they keep talking about, you know, since the next episode is presumably called Timeless Children. So making it sound like there's more than one, but the one specific one that keeps being touted. What if that is Ruth? What if she isn't really a doctor? And the reason that she can be called the doctor, according to Chibnall, is because part of the plan to hide her was plan A, hide her on Earth as a human. If that fails, plan B, we've got a chameleon arch set up with an imprint of the doctor, maybe taken from the Matrix, something. Somehow they have the doctor's lives or life, a part of the doctor some way, somehow. Even something that they fabricated in that chameleon arch, that's plan B, make or hide as the doctor. Because if she's traveling all throughout time and space as the doctor, how are you going to differentiate Ruth from the actual doctor all throughout history? But the other part of that that makes me think that is that in the episode, when Ruth kind of, as a sleeper agent, got woken up and she had that fight scene where she tore the horn off a rhino, there's things that don't sit that she's a doctor, even if it's an alternate timeline thing, unless she's lived another life where, you know, pacifism isn't really her way. Aside from the bit with the gun at the end, she kind of felt a little bit more doctor there. I wonder if there's a bit that she is the doctor because in her mind right now, she is the doctor in the same way Tennant was John Smith. I guess I'll say it that way. And I'm wondering if that's the case. I'm wondering if she's more important in this timeless child kind of way, and she needs to be awoken to be who she actually is. But right now they furnished her with a TARDIS that they made look like a police box that they had hidden as a backup plan, and this chameleon arch that was also part of the backup plan.
Interesting. I think I've read that there's the next episode's a bit longer. So I think it's an hour or an hour and 10.
But even if it is, you've still got a lot of elements to put into a story starts to feel messy. Because I liked last season's finale because it felt self-contained. I mean, yes, it had the reappearance of a villain that was generated that season. But ultimately, it felt like it wasn't pushing the barriers. It was just doing a story without this.
It was low-key as well, wasn't it?
It was low-key, yeah. And that I really liked. And I kind of feel that this story just feels like it could be an earth shock. You could do this very nicely without the Master, without Gallifrey, without Timeless Children, and do it as a two-parter. And that would still really sit well as an end finale. We don't, as we've said a million times before, you don't have to constantly be amping up the destruction of everything or the rewriting of everything. But we have that, so we've got to go with it. I don't know. And as I say, one of these sort of things I like these days is just not to try and work it out. It's just to try and go in and let them surprise me. Because if I did work it out and then I find out I'm right, I'll get no pleasure out of that. I'll get no satisfaction. So why try and find the answer ahead of time in a weird way?
Totally.
But obviously, that's because that's part of our job.
But wait, real quick. I'm just curious. If you work out the plot, you say you take no entertainment from
that? Absolutely. Is that real? Satisfaction. Well, yeah, really? Because, I mean, if I watched yesterday's, not knowing anything means that every part of it interests me, even the bits which aren't that interesting. If I knew, for instance, if I'd read the synopsis beforehand, and I know this is a bit more of an extreme example, I might still enjoy the episode, but I will probably enjoy it less. Okay, better example is Good Omens. I watched Good Omens this week with a friend, and I read the book a few years ago, and I was enjoying the film, the miniseries, but there was a part of me which was kind of like, I would really be enjoying this more if I just didn't know the book. And I don't know the book really well. It was a few years ago, but just enough that it's just deadening moments where I perhaps would be more engaged because I wouldn't know that these two characters are going to be present throughout the whole thing. And I know their relationship remains stable, etc., etc. And it's kind of the same thing when you sort of guess ahead. If you guess ahead and you're right, it's kind of like, well, you're not surprising me. The chance to surprise me is gone because I've already worked it out. I've spoiled myself, essentially. Okay, it wasn't facts, but I, in my own head, I'd come to those conclusions. So really finding that out has given me no pleasure. I'd have more pleasure to be the person who didn't realise, and then at the moment they wanted me to go, oh, hell, that's what this is all about. That's really interesting. I'll now be thinking about this as I'm watching it. I am engaged. So it's that sort of thing. It's a long answer.
Yeah, no, that's and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. I'm not trying to say that.
Oh, I know you were.
I found it an interesting perspective because when I watch, part of the fun for me is figuring out what's going on. So if I do clock onto something, even moments before it happens, I'm like, it depends. If I clock onto it first and it's kind of not a good thing, and I'm like, oh, please don't go there, and they do, then I'm a little disappointed. But like the Mary Shelley story, I think I told you guys that I was like, man, wouldn't this episode be great if the Lone Cyberman was in this? And then he was, and I was like, oh, this is so great.
But you see,
I'm on the opposite spectrum from you, I guess.
But I'd say it's almost like there's almost a Venn thing going on here between audience and writers, where there's a sort of there is a period of time where the writer is happy for you to clock the information before you get to it. So I would say in that episode of the Cybermen, they were happy with you getting the satisfaction of working out it's probably going to be a Cyberman, because the Frankenstein, the Cybermen, we'd already spoke about Lone Cybermen in this series so far. If you clocked that, they were probably like, that's okay. It's sort of like Utopia. If you get it's the Master when they're doing the sort of like the yarn a bit, you are not alone before before the voices. I think there's like an acceptable period of an audience clocking and them going, it's okay. You can take that pleasure because we're expecting some of you to get it by this point. But by this point, we've already got you. We've got you long enough to let you have that satisfaction without feeling you've guessed us. Do you know what I mean? Is that little space beforehand?
That's a perfect example too, because I was going to say like the Usual Suspects with
Kaiser
Soze, but you use Professor Yana, and I remember every one of us sitting there going, "Oh my God, how did we not see that?" So that's okay. That's perfect point. I get what you're saying there. Right?
That can be quite elastic, that period. So it's not always like the scene before. It can be a little longer, like I say, with the Cyberman and the Frankenstein. Yeah. But I think generally there's that bit. It's like with the Kaiser Soze, they're showing you all the pictures, and it's before you, they actually say it. If you've worked it out before, it doesn't matter because they've got you, like you say, for the majority of the movie. It's like, well, that's fine. We're happy with that.
When was that supposed to have got that? Because I saw Usual Suspects about 20 years ago, 25 years ago.
Well, I mean, I'm thinking in my head when they're stuck, there's a bit before they actually specifically say, or before you see the walk change, where they're going through all the material. And there's a bit of a montage thing as they're trying to work things out. And I think if you get it just before then, I think the writers are like, that's fine. You can get it at this point because we've kept you blind for 90 minutes. If you get it before we announce it or before the change in the body movement or it doesn't matter. We've had you. We've had our fun. We've played the card. And I think the best writing is obviously when they can do that with the cards in play and you've not noticed them. And then they can go, but it was there all along and you've just not seen it. Like, to some degree, Yarn is a bit that way, and probably not totally, because Yarn is not exactly a real clue, but I think those are always the good ones, and that's what they're always striving for. So yeah, so it depends, but it's an interesting idea. It's interesting conversation.
Do you know, that's one of the there's probably two, maybe three, I think it's two moments in Doctor Who that I've rewatched since it came back repeatedly, that is one of them. It doesn't even have to be the full episode, definitely. Just that past 10 minutes, because it's so good. And the other one is the end of The Day of the Doctor in the gallery with the other doctor, the curator. Those two really get me going.
I like the beginning of Utopia with Jack jumping on a TARDIS. I think that's a really fun dynamic moment. Christmas Invasion, I think the opening of that is a lot of fun dynamic moment that I could rewatch. The piece you're saying at the end of Utopia as well, again, really strong, strong bit. Most of the moments I like tend to be in those eras, but this was really good. And I also like the fact we get some nice doctor speeches as well, where she's telling them all that, you know, you can't come along. Again, seeing that sort of slightly more angry and it's good to see that, and I think that complements her personality.
What's happened there, do you think? Because it's like between the beginning of the season and the end of the season, she has gained, I think I said this in the series 11, she's gained the authority that she seemed to not have last time around.
I suppose they kind of saying, well, it's something we've been building over the season. She has that line in Arachnids that, you know, you will change, you know, this is not safe, is almost like preempting a lot of stuff. But I think I don't feel it's been paced out well enough. We needed some of this sooner. It's a bit like you can justify it, but it doesn't make it satisfying, in the same way that having Rose and the Doctor having loads and loads of fun in series two to build up to pay off with Doomsday is like, well, fine, but I've had to endure sort of 10 episodes of them being really annoying to get this payoff. That's not satisfying. And we needed this sort of side of Jodie, I think, earlier. Didn't even have to be directed at them, but we just needed some tonality. And she needed it as well. I think that must make it far more engaging as an actress to play.
Do you think so? Yeah. All right, let's hit Facebook.
Yep.
And we won't do it like that because that app is rubbish. Let's hit Facebook and find out what our listeners have been saying about Ascension of the Cybermen. Hamish Bell, New Who, Cybermen get Earthshock scary in a bleak, steady-paced episode that exudes a sense of ever-increasing menace and fear. I think he liked it. A hard one to judge without its closing factor, he concludes. Andy Walker, it upped the stakes suitably. Ashad, anagram of Shada, I hadn't noticed. Is a mean enough villain, and the Cyber Warriors are a good combo of new and classic. Space felt dangerous again. Yeah. I like the Brendan subplot. Is he Ginger at last or at first? Jonathan Roberts loved the episode. New Cybermen look fab, apart from Orphan 55. This has been a strong series. Katie Poole, I missed. She has just commented while we've been recording. Another hit for me. I really enjoyed it. Slightly apprehensive as a lot of loose plot points hinge on next week's episode being coherent and well-written, which isn't often the case with episodes written around the Master, she suggests. Phil Vernon, enjoyed it while I was watching it. Can't remember much about it in hindsight. Not sure if there was much there in the way of plot, but still interested to see how the story season resolves itself. Lewis David Blaney, epic! And a lot more besides. Nick Griffiths, proper monster romp. Best Jodie Epp, really enjoyed it. Andy Kaminsky, captivated all the way through. Jeff Waddell, must just be me. I thought it was outstanding. I'm calling it the best three if next week's lands, I'm calling it as the best three episode run since 2005. Pretty enjoyable, says Luke James. For recent cyber finales, I don't think it's as good as Dark Water or World Enough in Time, but an enjoyable romp with some nice Earthshock vibes. And yeah, it's just generally all the way. Everyone loves it. More or less everyone loves it, apart from the usual exception. So in television terms, that's job done, isn't it? You put a TV show together, you put it out, everyone likes it. That's pretty much what you want from it. There is, of course, the other side of things, which is the thing that certain people obsess over, which ultimately aren't massively important, and that is the audience figures. And we will briefly cover that. The episode Ascension of Cybermen had an overnight figure of 3.71 million, which is kind of in keeping with the last few episodes, which have been resolving. Can You Hear Me? Had something around the same overnight and came in at 4.9. So, yeah, we'll just have to, as we said, we're not going to draw on this because we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. No one's watching telly. So if there's a special drive to start making people watch telly again and they're putting millions into it and the audience figures across the board are staying the same, then, yeah, that's time to worry. But in terms of how things are at the moment, then... Yeah, exactly. You know, there's no justification for there not being another series or another series or another series of Doctor Who based on audience figures because fewer people are watching television. It's as simple as that.
I mean, just again, out of the three of us, who watched it on live? I didn't.
I didn't. I watched it at 9 o'clock.
No, I didn't either.
Yeah. So, I barely watched an episode this season on time, but last night I had to take my son to the hospital because he jumped off the side of the bath and banged his head on the other side of the bath.
Oh dear.
Silly boy.
I take it he's okay.
He seems fine.
Gotcha. Good, good. Back on topic, that I think sort of kind of suggests you've got three people who are not only long-term watchers of it, but also have to speak about it the next day, and none of them are watching it live, kind of sort of suggests how audiences are shifting and changing. Yeah. And we're not the 20-somethings either. So again, how people sort of fixate on overnights, as if that tells you. And then sort of says how that relates to previous years when television was different and compares the two. It's like, you know, my dinner here is really, really hot, but these other dinners previous were really cold. Why are they not the same? It's because they're different periods and they've made... That was the worst analogy ever. I don't know.
Cleese, Bark and Corbett thing going on there.
Well, yeah, but so it could have been. So if anyone on Facebook wants to sort of redefine what I said and actually... give me a good analogy for what I was trying to say, because obviously you're not. Please do.
Let me ask you guys this, because like James said, you know, like watching the episode yesterday was important because we had to record the podcast today. Watching the episode on time, not so much as important, because obviously I kind of feel more... I think when the X-Files ended, and this is going back, I said to myself, no more. I can't be glued to a TV at a specific hour, you know, every day, you know, or once a week, because what if there's something better going on at that time that I'm missing because I had to sit here and watch a TV show? And that changed a little bit when the new series of Doctor Who came. Obviously, here in America, watching series one was much more difficult because we didn't get it when you guys got it. But after that, you know, there was a time period where, yeah, I made sure that I was glued when the thing was airing. But nowadays... do you guys watch anything as it airs, or are you catching everything when it's convenient for you?
That's a good question. I was just thinking as you're saying that, the only thing we watch regularly as it goes out on a weeknight is Holby City. I say we, Kerry, and that is because it's on at 9 o'clock, so we've got the children settled down, everything's sorted out, and you know, kitchen's tidied up. I might have bits and bobs of work to do, which is why I don't watch it religiously, although I do tend to pay attention when particular people on screen, like Hugh Quarshie. But generally speaking, that's the only show because of the time it goes out and because everything's sorted and it's time to sit down. But most of the time, we're not watching telly anyway. We're not watching any network telly, or certainly not watching any live TV, still on our massive NCIS quest. Although we're up to about season 15, so that's about 2-3 years ago now, so we're making good ground there. There's Time Team, there's on YouTube now, classic episodes of Time Team from across the series, so there's loads of interesting things there to watch. And, you know, when all the other stuff's out of the way, we've got to catch up with Man in the High Castle and other stuff on Amazon and Netflix, so... Network TV, there's not an awful lot of... it doesn't hold an awful lot of interest beyond... maybe stuff that's on BBC4, some BBC1 stuff, but again, that just gets watched on iPlayer. You know, we haven't watched Would I Lie to You live for a couple of series now. It always ends up being watched on iPlayer.
I don't watch any live TV at all, so this is the only BBC thing I'll watch on catch up. And that's it. I watch weekly, me and my friend are watching Picard on Fridays, and that's the only sort of weekly thing that we, you know, is almost like a ritual Friday is Picard Day. Beyond that, no, everything. And as you say, there's so many things to watch. You know, just finished watching Good Omens. This weekend, finished Lost in Space season one and moved on to season two. We've got, you know, we've got Preacher. We need to carry on with that. So American Gods. We've got Altered Carbon's coming back next month. Brooklyn Nine-Nine's coming back for its sixth on Netflix next month. Castlevania, I made the mistake of starting to watch, so that's coming back next month. Still behind on Killing Eve. Still behind on, you know, I could just go through Vikings, Black Sails.
Yeah.
It's just so much to be watching. And it's got to the point where we're sort of saying, well, you know, kind of liking the Picard on Fridays and just having one episode a week rather than feeling this pressure of multiple episodes to catch up on or binge. And that sort of enjoyment becomes less. And I've been quite enjoying going back and watching old Star Trek Next Generations on Netflix just because of the simplicity of the episodic format, where you're not drawn into these constant serializations, which were great. But now it's like it's just so tense or stressful. I just want to watch something which stands alone.
That's a good point. And I'll tell you what, I'm sorry, Christian, but Next Generation is on network TV syndication, obviously, when I get home from work. So I've been watching that. That's something I've been like making. And mostly it's like I'm either watching it or it's on in the background because I know it so well. Yeah. But it is an oddity to think that there is something that's aired at a specific time of day that I do make sure I turn the TV on for, but it's not something new. I think Picard is a different issue for me, by the way, because for you guys, if you want to watch it, you got to subscribe, you got to watch it. For us, CBS was a network TV station. All the shows on that, including Star Trek and whatnot, or whatever, wherever was on there, you know, it was network TV. You watched it when it aired because it was, free, I guess. You know, you sit there and you watch the advertising, so it's your time, but it was free TV. But then they go ahead and they put Picard, you know, a TV show based on Next Generation, something that speaks to so many of us and we all want to watch it. But they're like, but if you want to watch it, you got to subscribe to our online service. And
CBS Access, yeah.
I can't do that because this is a free TV station that you're now making me pay to watch a TV show. And that doesn't jive with me. So I'm missing it because I'm not paying because it's one TV show I'm going to watch to pay for. That's it. Doesn't make sense.
I think we're probably, when we do another show with Gareth, I think we're probably going to talk about the BBC and the shape of things there and what's coming in the future and possibilities for how it will probably inevitably be redefined. And so I don't want to get into this too much, but I do wonder whether this kind of, obviously we don't know what the audience figures are for Netflix and Amazon, etc. But I do wonder if the impact of these shows on the BBC and the decrease in, say, casual TV viewing, let's call it, when held in contrast with large sporting events, I wonder if that's going to actually impact the satellite TV channels in some way, whether actually BBC and ITV are actually going to put more effort into event TV that the event actually already exists and they don't actually have to produce it. All they have to do is buy into a, you know, a camera feed and put some commentators there. I wonder if that's actually going to be how they're going to start tent polling stuff and maybe even start moving towards US sports as well. At the moment, I don't see any way out because, you know, what we were talking about, what we watch regularly. Well, there's another show I watch regularly, Midsummer Murders, which is an ITV show. And I haven't watched that live for ages. The current, there's a run on at the moment, which is like spread over several months and around sporting events and awards events and stuff like that. There's been two or three episodes so far. The series before that was aired last year, but I watched it on BritBox the year before that via a VPN on the US version of BritBox. It had already been aired in Australia in 2018, and it was only on in the UK from the end of 2018 through 2019. So again, another show that I watch regularly, haven't watched it live for years. So I think ITV are kind of in the same boat as the BBC, not so much with the license fee issue, because that isn't an issue with them, but in terms of drama audiences.
I think the whole model is changing so much so that, like you say, to some degree, funnily enough, in a weird way, you could look at the sort of VOD packages and see they carry, even though they are commercialized, they had their framework relates more to the BBC than it does to ITV, in the terms that adverts only exist to promote shows within its catalogue.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of them don't even have that. And, you know, they can be, I mean, Prime is fairly intrusive, I think, really, for its adverts. But and Netflix, not so much so, but they have that sort of structure to them. So I think ITV is in a problem because their model is not the current model either. It's a different model. It's, as you say, it's a commercial advertisements rather than subscriptions or license fee. But yeah, I think they're in the same boat. It's that question of what does, you know, where does live television sit? You know, what can be done with it to make it viable? And how do you make it viable enough of the time to make it workable?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's 2020. This year we've got the Olympic Games and we've got the European Football Championships. So those are two key examples of sporting events that are going to make drama look very tiny in comparison. So, I mean, there's always going to be some tentpoling with drama stuff there. But then again, drama stuff's going to get moved around for, particularly for the Olympics. So it's, yeah.
But then you have, the problem is you have people like Amazon who have got a slightly different model to Netflix, where they're trying to incorporate into subscriptions a multiplicity of services.
Mm.
And they already have sports sections.
They do,
so
yeah.
Will they start looking at trying to do what Sky was doing and start trying to buy up key sporting and
yeah.
thus
which
again
is where
take
I
away.
Was going to go with this, which impact with satellite TV, with Sky, yeah.
So it's, I don't know.
Fascinating time.
And again, it feels like it's a time where soon enough you're going to go back, almost like the 40s, where you're going to go turn around and go, do we need regulation here? Do we need to carve up this private sector, which is starting to go like, well, Disney's going, well, we're having all our content and we're putting it under a subscription. And, you know, Netflix is going, well, we're doing this amount of original shows, which you can only see through this, and Amazon's doing, you know, and they're carving up the industry to a point where, you know, there's very few areas for any other, for competition. The competition starts to dry up and you'll end up, do you end up with like four big things, you know, the Amazons, the Murdochs, the Netflixes, and is there anything else? Not really. Is am I missing one? Netflixes, Amazons, Murdochs, that's now as well. Oh, and Disney's. Disney.
Yeah.
Well, you know, is Hulu going to struggle once these major powers start to really... I mean, Disney now pulling everything in and then playing a very different approach to how it makes shows, in the sense that its film content is now being seriously dispersed into television content, but it's all going to be under the same platform, so it doesn't really matter. In a sense, you know, that's a really interesting thing that they're doing.
I also feel that you have, I apologize there, but you've got Netflix, Hulu, and YouTube that are making a ton of new TV series, but I hear about like maybe one or two of them, you know, like who's watching all of them?
Well, that's the other problem, the market saturation. Where is the saturation point to where markets can no longer sustain because there's too much for people to consume?
Yeah, well, I mean, there is a possibility of heading towards another dot-com boom, a sort of a TV dot-com boom and bust, or in the dot-com bubble burst. This could be like, there's a possibility of a saturation point and a drama bubble burst, and there'd be no more, you know, Netflix and Amazon in particular having a massive problem, and the smaller ones impacted by that. People decide, well, they want this or this, so, you know, Hulu goes, Disney will survive, no doubt.
Have they sort of got around that? Because I mean, before the bubble burst that the journalists I talked to were suddenly talking about was on the basis that there was so many channels sort of coming into existence, you know, like the crime drama channel and the cooking channel, that these channels, there was going to be too much content that channels couldn't sustain. But if we move to like these VOD packages where you're subscribing X amount a month that sustains that channel, if they have enough people putting money into that, it doesn't really matter to some degree, as long as, you know, you can sustain your... And if people are now going to float between, say, four major companies or five, if we do hope that Hulu carries on, is that will it be enough that they can sustain themselves, but there'll be no room for any other market forces?
Well, I think that the impact will be that the one that's been predicted. And, you know, we talked about this before. We've known about that this is going to come along like 25 years ago, and yet certain broadcasters are still hanging on to the past in a Luddite sort of a way, that channels are going to close.
Well, yeah, or they will be closed by new buyers. How long is it before Disney or Amazon probably, you know, like becoming the major players, consume one of its opponents?
Yeah, I mean, all the things on satellite or cable, like, they, you know, all these, like you mentioned, cooking channels before, like all these cooking channels. I don't know anyone who watches cooking channels anymore.
Well, that's for me. So those.
All that stuff you can get online either on Amazon or on YouTube or on the dedicated website. So
I think those sort of bubbles will burst. But will these big companies be, as you say, well protected and survive it? But we'll see a massive drop off in, and that becomes a problem for those who have like Freeview boxes, and like, will they start to lose that sort of content and be forced to decide on one of these bigger names, which arguably, as we, you know, and that goes back to the same question of the license fee, you know, the prices compared to license fee. And I know a lot of people will say, well, the license fee brings you more content than one variety of content than what Netflix does. And I'm not arguing against that. I'm just saying, when people are looking for what they tend to consume compared to how much they want to pay, and they all see the deal that Amazon or, you know, like Disney Plus's deal at the moment, which is, you know, their lure deal is very, very, very competitive. Will they just go for that and just stick with one and just consume that content? And as you say, all the Freeview stuff just dies.
Yeah.
You know, commercial advertising television and license fee television is killed by two different means, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, that is something that we're going to come back to in the future. And now we're going to be taking some time off after the next couple of episodes of the podcast with a K. We'll be off for a month, and then we'll be back with some new episodes. And hopefully we'll be getting Gareth on board to have a chat about things as they have been and things to come. Guys, we should probably offer ratings for Ascension of the Cybermen. I know it's a two-parter, but we do kind of do this on a episode-by-episode basis. Where possible, and, you know, there's the opportunity to revise your score next week should you wish to. Who wants to go first?
I'm happy.
I was gonna say
I prefer this because, like, I'm by the sounds of it, Brian really liked The Doctor Falls. Well, I really liked World Enough and Time, but I hated The Doctor Falls. So I'm kind of glad we give individual scores, because I think as a pair they're averaged out for me, while I, you know, while I, as I say, I really rate the first one. So for this one, I would suddenly give a 9. So nice and easy, really.
Yeah, I would agree with 9.
Yeah, I can't differ from that. I will say that, unfortunately, the conclusion of a multiple part story does kind of retroactively change the grading or a system going backward. But right now I'm at a 9 with you guys, but I'm like, I am concerned, because as we talked about, there's a lot to pack in next week. I'm hoping to be able to sit here next week and say a 9 again. I'd be happy to say a 10. I don't know if we're gonna get that, but I'd be happy to enjoy it. I've been quite pleased with the last two episodes, and a small handful of moments or an episode or two here throughout the rest of the season. So all in all, fingers are firmly crossed, because I think they can do it. The question is, will they?
Yeah. So 3 9s. Richard E. Grant, Rowan Atkinson, and Christopher Eccleston, perhaps. We will be back next week. Keep those comments coming on the Facebook page. And the Timeless Children are coming, and we'll be back to speak about them next week. From all of us, goodbye.